Saturday, 16th July, 1977.
On one occasion, when the Buddha's monks were talking, and he waited outside, and when there was a lull in the talk, he coughed, tapped on the door, and then went in. He inquired what was going on. And one of the things he said was this: when you are gathered together, especially in a large group, and usually the groups were in the hundreds or even in the thousands, the figures often mentioned are right up to 2,500 gathered together. So you can imagine what the talking sounded like. He said, either observe the Aryan silence or, if there is to be talk, let your talk be on the Dhamma, on religion. He very specifically laid down that all idle talk, vain talk, gossip and so on was to be completely eschewed. See? Now, in our group summer schools, and occasionally here, we have tried to have a what I call considering together. And this is a very difficult, thing to do in the right way. Our upbringing and education and our civilization is of such a nature that it is extremely difficult to avoid discussing as the world discusses, argumentatively, or with the intention of learning about facts, or as it is sometimes called, discovering truth as a piece of information which can be passed on from he who knows the truth to those who do not know the truth. We can't avoid that. We are conditioned that way and have been conditioned like that for centuries. Two of the very powerful influences which have brought about that situation, certainly in what we call the advanced countries of the world, has been the growth of science and factual knowledge, on the one hand, and the type of education that we have. The discussing in terms of arguing in order to put over one's own point of view as being the correct one. We do not attempt to develop our sensitivity in such a manner that the truth which is the actual reality of the immediate situation in its wholeness and in its significance reveals itself to us. Now this is a case where we must see quite clearly that we have to develop that kind of sensitivity. You see? I'll just stop. The releasing of this kind of sensitivity is one of the very remarkable results of living the religious life in the true sense. Because this means releasing powers which lie dormant in the organism, in the mind, particularly I should say in the psyche. They are there, ready to be released. And if they are released, then it becomes truly possible to live the religious life, call it the holy life, or call it the yogic life. This is one of the deep purposes of yoga as such. This kind of purpose has been presented not too adequately as the development of psychic powers. Now I think that is rather a deficient type of approach. Because when we say, oh, you will develop psychic powers that way, the conception which the listener or reader forms is that I am going to develop this, that and the other. Which is exactly what religion is not about. There is nothing for me. That we must realize. Not just believe or have as a thought in our minds. That must be fully understood and realized. One doesn't merely accept it. One doesn't have secret reactions in the depths of the mind against it. You see? To realize it means that you really have seen it and you say, well, of course that is so. There is nothing for me. Because this me is compounded of all those aspects and elements of human nature. That is, human nature as it is by and large, which are obstructions and offer resistance to the free flow of transcendence into us and out of us. We have to become emptied, which means that the organism has to become a truly fit instrument, an fully sensitized instrument on all possible wavelengths which are human wavelengths for the inflow of the reality, the truth of transcendence itself. And when this happens, what we have called psychic powers are there naturally present. And whatsoever is there naturally present is something, or rather I should say, has become naturally present, is never misused. Then you do not misuse any power, any faculty. Otherwise every faculty which we have gets misused sometime, somewhere, somehow. See, this is a very serious matter, because it is precisely this which produces the suffering which we see everywhere in the world, in our own selves and in our environment. comes through energy which has gone awry in its manifestation. Instead of being constructive and truly creative, it has exploded. You see what I mean? And when we use this word purity or purification in the context of religion, we mean just that, that transformation of our own psyche in such a manner that one sees the truth. Intelligence truly flowers out in the human organism. And that means that from moment to moment one sees the whole situation as it is, and one is unresisting towards that situation. Put it in another form, one becomes inclusive with respect to the entire situation. And in becoming wholly inclusive, then one can consider the situation in its fullness. When one can do that, then one is no longer a producer of conflict. Why do peace treaties always fail? Because the participants in a peace treaty are each concerned with getting the best out of the other, which means that they are offering resistance to the wholeness of the situation. They are fragmenting it. See? When we cease to fragment that way, then at last the mind, which is the universal, transparent light of transcendence itself, you see, the mind functions freely, inclusively, creatively. Mind is the creative energy of the manifested universe. And this is one of the deep purposes of any religious discipline in the true sense, discipline in the true sense, a learning. And this learning process never ceases for the simple reason that the living organism is living through time. And living through time means living through a perpetually changing situation and circumstance. Therefore, you've got to see in the now, at once, the wholeness of things. There's no question of a finality. Those who participate in peace treaties are completely ignorant of all this. See? They may be in their own judgment, devout Christians or Buddhists or Hindus or whatever it is. But these are just meaningless terms. In order to consider together, have a true religious sensitivity, then they are free of that exclusive, conflict-producing selfness and self-interest, vested interest, which produces conflict. They are free of that. If they are free of that, the whole psychophysical organism is at peace within itself. If it is at peace within itself, it is really alive. It is awake. It is energetic. And in that state, the individuals who are there can contribute their best, the essence of the matter, and understand the essence of the matter as presented by each one of them can understand what the others want to convey. So you see, there is a truly harmonious interchange. We may compare this with an orchestra. Each one is sounding the right note at the right time. And therefore, there is the release of a living harmony from moment to moment. And in that living harmony, the discords and concords each play their parts. The discords corresponding to differences or disagreements where the presentation of viewpoints is concerned, and the concords corresponding to the agreements of viewpoints. So one knows that you haven't got to waste any energy upon harmonizing what everyone sees clearly for himself, that is seen by everybody. But the differences which are presented are things which each individual considers carefully, looks into carefully, sees what they really stand for, and sees the way in which they are related to one's own viewpoint, which differs from the other person's. If one doesn't see that relationship, however different viewpoints may be, there are always relationships between them. If one doesn't see those relationships, there is the state of continuous discord. But if one sees the relationships and truly understands them, there is no problem of, shall I accept this or shall I reject it? One has seen the truth, seen the fact as the fact, and knows we must act thus and thus. And that is all there is to it. And obviously, no question of self-interest comes into the situation. Where there is no self-interest involved, there is no obstruction throughout the psychophysical organism to the influence and power of transcendence itself at work. Now, transcendence works not just in one way. There are modes of expression, fundamental main modes of expression of transcendence. Transcendence is energy, it is power, it is the unknown, it is the unknowable by the brain. Do remember that all the time. But as it makes its impress upon the individual organism, one particular aspect or other comes out prominently for the time being. These are the great archetypal manifestations of this, of transcendence, which is creative power, acting creatively in eternity, not in time. When that impress works through the living organism, which functions in space-time, then it comes out in particular forms, or shall we say, that which is formless and so forth is reflected through our psyche and body in terms of particular forms, which are finite, limited, mortal. The other is infinite, unlimited, immortal. See? Now these archetypal forms of expression of transcendent energy have had names given to it, to them, through the ages. These are the names of the archangels, the angels, the asuras, the suras, the so-called demons, and so on. When you get a rather narrowly theistic type of presentation of all this, you find invariably and inevitably that there is a rejection of the demonic forces. People are frightened of what they are, what they term demonic forces, because it is the business of the demonic forces to bring about the process of change in universal evolution in a somewhat abrupt and maybe frightening and maybe disrupting manner. But this can't be avoided. Supposing you have a human being who is a perfected one, a holy one, he too dies, and the moment of death is sudden, it is disruptive, is it not? This thing which we call life has vanished completely and suddenly out of that organism. It is like an explosion where that organism is concerned. We know the stark unanswerability where death is concerned. We know that. You see? So this has its place in the scheme of things. But as and when it comes about in the right way, then it implies that the point of complete fulfillment, perfection, consummation is over. And it is past. See? So, this art of considering together involves the development of this very deep and profound sensitivity within ourselves. A sensitivity which does not just say either yea or nay to the other, but absorbs the whole of what he is and is trying to present to us. Then, if we remain poised and have that inward freedom, we can make a true response. And this responding, this receiving in fullness, and this responding in fullness is the music, if you like, of human intercourse, human communication, and it is an expression of true communion as such. Why is it that when we attempt this in our modern world, we do not succeed too well? One of the sources of the lack of success is just this. We are the prisoners of our fixed beliefs and convictions. If we have a fixed belief, we have it in association with the idea, I know the truth, this is so. Anything contrary to it must necessarily be untrue. If that fixed belief is disrupted by the point of view presented by another person, or even shaken seriously, our ego is so hurt that we are immediately in antagonism towards that person. You see? We just can't take it from him or her. I'll teach him a lesson, and out will come a whole heap of arguments and so forth. There is a delicious a passage in one of the long discourses of the Buddha where he is explaining the Paticca Samuppada, the set of 12 factors which are responsible for the whole mass of ill and suffering. And in a particular discourse, this is expounded several times through different discourses, but in one particular discourse, the Buddha branches off from one element and shows how we end up with quarreling, blows, and suffering. Comes right down to the physical level. We occasionally hear of certain slight disturbances in the Mother of Parliaments as it carries on its business. Scenes which are not exactly dignified or human. We know that. Now consider, why is that? These people are convinced this is right, and if anybody presents something which rather shakes this point of view, they'll even descend to blows over it. Hardly gentlemanly or ladylike. But in ordinary everyday life, this is just what happens, doesn't it? We are unable to consider together. We are separated in our consciousness to such an extent that the other person must necessarily be wrong if he is not in agreement with me. You know, Western music is such a marvelous teacher. It really is a wonderful teacher of the profoundest things. The way concords and discords both have their place in the whole scheme of harmony. Really marvelous. We all know how in the school of Pythagoras, music played a very important part. And in those old schools, not only in the school of Pythagoras, I mentioned Pythagoras because that is a very well-known example to the Western world. But you have this training in music in a great many, if not possibly all, the great religious centers the world has seen. Training in music. And note carefully that whilst we approach and understand and accept music from the point of view of pleasure, of uplift, of bringing a calming influence upon us and so forth, those people, the religious people, saw deeper and realized that here was something which made the psychophysical being more and more truly human, that is, selfless, non-egoistic. This is something which it would be well for us to think about a great deal and try and introduce it every day in our lives. And the whole of life, especially in this particular day and age, offers such a large number of situations and stimuli to call for this kind of considerateness. Considerateness not merely in the sense of enduring the other fellow. No, no, no. Because enduring the other fellow raises up an opposition within the depths of the psyche, the hidden depths. Not merely that kind of considerateness, but this power to see the relationships between the impulses, the influences that are coming from him towards oneself and one's own one's own knowledge and views and so forth. Then there will grow within us the faculty of introducing harmony in the true sense all the time throughout the day in each and every situation. Admittedly, it's extremely difficult because the forces of turmoil are so great, so powerful all the time. The sheer noise of traffic, for instance, is something which certainly makes my head reel. And it's very difficult to remain mindful under those circumstances. Very difficult. And when in human relationships something goes wrong, or something hurtful takes place, or whatever it is, you see, the upset is tremendous. And you will notice particularly, we are two sensitive people, two rich personalities come together and are, as we commonly say, love each other in any shape or form, man and wife, friend and friend, whatever it may be, you see. It becomes far more difficult for them than for this person and that person who is considered as, oh, that other man, that stranger, that acquaintance. I know him a little bit, and one doesn't react, therefore, in terms of upset. But that non-reaction is simply due to indifference, on the one hand, or a deliberate shutting out of the other person, which is, again, a state of disharmony. These are very difficult things, very difficult things. But this is our school of life. And if in this school of life we use our eyes and ears and touch and sensitivities in the right way, then we are certainly reading the book of life aright, in the right way. Not only merely reading the book of life, we are actually writing this book of life as we continue to live thus. This is one of the profound meanings of the living of the religious life, the holy life, the whole life. See? It is one of the deep things that comes about through any religious discipline which is worthy of the name religious discipline, call it yoga or mysticism or whatever you like. One other point in this connection and then I'll stop talking. It can never be emphasized too much. That we are always dogged with this terrible aspect of things. Something desirable to be brought about. Of course it is desirable, but the meaning of the word desirable here completely transcends the worldly meaning of desirability. It is part of the great evolutionary process, the developmental process. There is a developmental process where every limited context is concerned. There is no such thing as a developmental process in relationship to the totality. The totality is the totality. You get the word development has meaning only insofar as a process of change is going on in a limited sphere in relation to other processes of change in other limited spheres. And the spheres are not separate. The universe is a universe, a one total reality. And see, if one really understands this, then one begins to see that the words purpose or this is the goal or something like that have meanings. Otherwise they have no meaning whatsoever. Now, we, being what we are, I at my stage of development, which is just learning the first half of the letter A, how to write it in the book of life, see. When I see this or hear this or read this, then immediately, here is something to attain, to achieve. The 9/10 of the iceberg of the psyche, which is the submerged part, looks at it as the worldling looks at it. You can't avoid it at first. But gradually, the separation disappears. You get the wholeness of things. And with it, that awakening to holiness within yourself. And not only an awakening within the deeps of the psyche, but the whole psychophysical being undergoes actual transformation in form and substance. You know how we use terms like, oh, he has a beautiful soul, or something like that. A naturally pure and lovely person, something like that, you see. We use terms like that. Why? Because he, being what he is, has that natural influence upon us. We see him like that. I mean, we all know in ordinary life, we see a beautiful woman, and of course, there is no question about it. One sees, there's a beautiful woman, or one sees a handsome man, or a person whose ways are gracious, or a person whose ways are the very reverse of gracious, and so forth. And we see it at once, don't we? That person radiates that kind of influence. So too, it has to be with the religious. He radiates the reality of transcendence. And this is something absolutely marvelous. This immediately gives meaning and purpose to life for us as human beings. And, as I said, suggested a little bit earlier in the other context, it is our fixed beliefs, our ideas, our conceptions of what ought to be, etc., which are the blockages to awakening to the whole truth. Because a fixed concept will not allow the psyche to grow, to become free of its inner conflicts and mistakes and so forth, and let pure mind function freely through that psyche. That is why fixed beliefs, it's the fixation part of it which is the trouble, not the belief in itself. The belief can be the first step. And if you are just aware of the fact that this is what I see at present, this is what I, and we say in ordinary parlance, oh, I believe so and so is what is good or right or whatever it is. But don't stick to the form of that belief, because the moment you have a fixation in the mind, it is an excrescence, it is excreta which putrefies inside the psyche and poisons the psyche. The willing and glad to see the process of change take place. But be sensible enough not to let it be any sort of haphazard change. You know the type of person who comes along and today he's believing this, tomorrow he's believing that, the day after tomorrow it's something else. He's just a blighted nuisance. Now, life becomes wonderful then, of its own, on its own, if one sees this. There is a restoration of this particular manifestation of life in its wholeness to the whole of life. The particular manifestation becomes fully related to the total manifestation. And this is the fulfillment of yoga, the rejoining, the restoring to the wholeness. This is mysticism, if you like, in the true sense. This is good sense religion in its full sense, practical sense. All the rest is unpractical. And then each individual, each one of us, becomes a focus point of the power of transcendence to work through and affect the world for good in the true sense. This power then never gets misused through us. It always functions rightly. Certain aspects, of course, as I said a little bit earlier, will be emphasized. Through Zarathustra, for instance, the aspect which was prominent, predominant, was the aspect of righteousness, purity. Purity was the great keynote of Zarathustrian religion and teaching. What is his triple formula for the living of the religious life and the fulfillment of man? Hu mata, hu kta, hu vrashta. Hu means the good, the absolute good. Mata, thought. Ukta, speech. Vrashta, action. Good thought, good word, good deed. But the meaning of good is not confined within an ambivalent sphere having an opposite called evil. It is the absolute good which has utterly integrated the conflict of the ambivalent good and evil and gone beyond it. But there are no words whatever available in any language for this going beyond, because that beyond transcends all limitation or finitude, and there are no words for that which transcends limitation and finitude. So you see, we just use the worldly dualistic term good rather than the worldly dualistic term evil. And if you tell a human being to work for the supreme evil, the supreme violence, you think you're a little bit, you're in need of some attention. Isn't that so? It's like that. So Zarathustra emphasized purity. We find in the case of the Buddha love and compassion. Wisdom and compassion. In the case of Jesus, he is the Lord of love, the Prince of peace. Peace I give unto you, my peace I give unto you, not as the world gives. There is the real key to unlock the transcendent significance of his use of the word peace. The peace I give unto you is not of this world, which is a case of everything being pleasant and quiet. which in due time disrupts into throwing bombs in the name of peace. Isn't that so? It's like that. And so it is with all the great spiritual teachers. Some aspect or other stands out predominantly. Occasionally, you get that type of person who is so constituted, that is to say, the psychophysical organism is so constituted that it is a receptacle equally wonderful, equally capable in relation to all the great archetypal forms of transcendent energy. Those are very rare cases. In Hindu yoga, we have that presented as the Raja Yogi. In him, everything is in combination there. The perfection of mind, wisdom, the perfection of love, compassion, the perfection of devotion, this flame of devotion, which is a light that heals and not scorches, the perfection of action, skill, capability, the perfection of the psychic powers, and so forth. All these are there together. Now you see, in the case of the Buddha, that is openly stated, that he had all these. In the case of Jesus, for instance, with respect to psychic powers, perhaps the miracles, as they are called, are indicators of the release of remarkable psychic powers. They all have everything, but something or other does stand out predominantly. So you see, what we call working towards the goal, working for the purpose of one's existence, has its meaning, provided we keep our brains, I am deliberately using the word brain, keep our brains clean, not cluttered up with fixed thoughts and beliefs and conceptions and all the rest. And in our life, in human communities and in human societies, in this life, here and now, there is continuous interchange between us human beings, isn't there? Continuous interchange of ideas, beliefs, continuous psychical interaction. And this is our great school in which we have to learn. Not only to read the book of life, but to write it in living words. And in the writing, we go through all the baptisms, the baptism by water and fire and everything.